Hi everyone, and welcome to Anesthesia Coffee Break. I'm Lahiri.
And I'm Stan.
And today, again, we've got a really exciting episode as we're going to talk about a performance tip as well as biz and EEG for trying to prevent awareness in anesthesia. So let's get started. Before we get started, the obvious disclaimer, this is just general medical information, especially for this exam, and it's just not medical advice for any specific patient. So please consult your treating team for any patient that you might be treating. Now, Stan,
it's your turn, La.
Oh, it's my turn, yep.
Yes, so La, it's your turn for a performance tip. And what's your performance tip for this week?
Yeah, I think this has happened to a lot of us, especially in anesthesia or crit care, where I was literally the sole person in a resus who had kind of the ALS credentials. And that was a really daunting experience. So fortunately, patient got through, survived, and all is good. And I really was thinking about what you said in the last episode about celebrating. And, you know, obviously this was a potentially horrific incident that, you know, went really well, as good as it could have gone. And I was just so relieved and happy for the rest of the day. And I thought, you know, if I could harness this, you know, this feeling of relief and happiness, which I think you can, because if you think of all the things you've done, whether, you know, whether you're a junior doctor or senior doctor, or whatever it is, you will have slowly built up these moments where, you know, you've done something pretty good, where you're relieved at the outcome and you're happy at the outcome. I started doing this thing with a person I was coaching for one of the exams, where we just go through our best moments in medicine. And you can probably do this for anything, where you have a list of some of your best moments, and that just helps you with your confidence. Like, this person's confidence may not be the best it could have been. And so we're just going through these moments where, you know, you can look back and go, yeah, look, I did really well. Like, I shouldn't feel bad about not passing this exam because I did well. I did that. I did this. And so I'm going to notch this one up on that list, because I started, after doing that with that particular trainee, I started making a list for myself because, you know, I think we're always hard on ourselves.
We're so privileged. I think we're so privileged in the work that we do that it affords us the opportunity to affect, you know, the people's lives the way that we can. And I think that you're right in terms of we can actually really make significant positive change in a lot of people's lives. And that is so meaningful, as you correctly described. And I think we all need to sit down and think about that. And it really does put perspective, doesn't it, in terms of what we do for this exam and what we do for work. And I think sometimes, you know, with those bad days, we just need to sit down, have a think about all these little moments in our lives. And I think it's such a good idea to sort of write it down so you can actually look back at it and go, you know what, I saved this man's life, or I made a positive change so that his life became better. And and it was you that did that. No one else did. And if you weren't there, things would have been different. So that is, it is momentous and life-changing.
As I was sharing this with some colleagues, they said, yeah, this sounds like a movie. You know, like, you know what, you know, in a way we're all the, you know, like we're an actor in our own movie. And, but, you know, the way the colleagues were kind of reflecting, it's like, yeah, that's proper movie. That's a
Dr. La MD, the new Netflix special.
Yeah, that's right.
Is there enough in the book for a Netflix special?
Oh, definitely not. No. And who wants to be on Netflix?
Can we do 9 episodes?
Anesthesia Coffee Break Netflix edition.
There's the new Squid Game too.
Oh my God, that would be horrible. But anyway, let's get started, because we want to get right into this. It's such a fascinating area. So I'll read out the short answer question where I guess you're going to go through this with. So describe the generation and features of a normal awake EEG briefly discuss the processing performed by quantitative EEG monitors such as BIS or entropy to produce a single number from the EEG. So that's a mouthful of a question with a whole bunch of complex things. So how do you break this down? Like, what do the examiners want? How do you think about this?
So with this question here, there's two components to it. So one is they wanted you to describe the basic functions of the EEG. And then after that, they wanted you to discuss either BIS or entropy, and the way that they're able to produce a single number. In other words, sort of talk about the algorithms involved. And we know that that the BIS algorithm is proprietary knowledge, so it's not widely available, but there are sort of key concepts that are there that are used in both BIS and entropy that we actually know about. So when we look at the examiner's report and the description of the EEG that they wanted, this probably came from a physiology textbook. And then after that, with the discussion of the algorithms, you can get it from, there's certain articles which talk about this. And I think what we'll do is we'll provide it in the link below. So that's essentially where the answers are going to come from. Now, when we talk about EEG, so what's EEG? So EEG records the spontaneous electrical activity of the brain. And the key thing is that the current is the summation of the excitatory and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials of pyramidal cells. That's a really key point to highlight, is that it's the summation. The reason why it's a summation is because all these potentials are really small. And the reason why it's unlike the ECG, where it's a propagated action potential, the reason why we don't have propagated action potentials in the brain is because of the myelin sheath, which acts like an excellent insulator. So unlike the heart, you don't get that propagated signal. But what you do instead is that you get the summation of all these excitatory and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. And that's what the EEG produces. Now, at its core, the rhythm is controlled by the thalamus. And what happens is that you get activation from the reticular, input from the reticular activating system, such as, sight, ears, and that causes your desynchronization. And the potentials for the EEG range anywhere from 0 to 200 microvolts. So just briefly with the frequency spectrum. So if we think about someone who is awake with their eyes open, that often produces beta waves, okay? So beta waves often have a wave frequency of 14 to 30 hertz. And then after that, when you close your eyes, you get alpha waves, and these are frequencies between 17 to 13 hertz. And then after that, with stage one sleep or general anesthesia or meditation, you start getting theta waves, which are 4 to 7 hertz. And stage two sleep also has theta waves, but now you get sleep spindles and K complexes. And then finally you get delta waves, which is less than 4 hertz, which you get in stage three, four sleep.
And so you've given a description of the EEG, and then you've outlined the four main frequency bands and what they are.
Yes, right. And then look, the frequency bands, that if you struggle to remember them, there is a pattern to it, although it's not perfect. So the patterns is four, so less than four, 4 to 7, 8 to 12, and then more than sort of 13. And that's how you could remember it if you sort of struggle. That's the pattern that I would use. It just comes up in fours. It's not accurate, but I think it's close enough. So the accurate version is less than 4 hertz for delta waves, 4 to 7 hertz for theta waves, 7 to 13 hertz for alpha waves, and 14 to 30 hertz for beta waves.
Sounds good.
Do you have any tricks at all, Lar, to remember this?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds really good. If you approximate it as 4, 8, 12, then yeah. Wow, that's the easiest thing ever to remember, really.
Yeah.
I remembered these wave roughly for the exam.
That's right. So I think I think it's close enough, because if you read different textbooks, they'll have different, just slightly different ranges. So I think it's okay to have that rough sort of guide for the exam. And then the last thing is they might talk about these gamma waves. So gamma waves are when you're concentrating, like we are currently at the moment, we're producing a lot of gamma waves, and you also get them in REM sleep as well. So these are very high frequency waves, anywhere sort of between 30 to 60 hertz. And that would be my description for the first part mm-hmm. of the question.
And so then the second part, I think you're trying to go into the algorithms used then. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So so that you can either talk about BIS or entropy. And I think that either one is fine because the concepts of both remain the same. At our institutions, we normally use BIS. Have you ever used entropy before?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of hospitals that use entropy. And again, it's pretty straightforward, just a number that you try to aim for. And that apparently would decrease awareness.
Yeah, that's
I
right.
I say apparently so, because there's
no, you gotta tell us about that, and that's good because I'll tell you the science behind it, but Lark can actually tell you the application of it because Lark's expertise is definitely in the part two domain. So with BIS, what it does, the algorithm at its core has two mainframes. So one is it has a time domain assessment. And then the second one is that it's got a frequency domain assessment. So what I mean by time domain assessment is that it examines how the EEG changes over time, all right? And what I mean by that specifically for BIS and entropy is the appearance of burst suppression. And the appearance of burst suppression, we know that occurs during deep anesthesia. And having the presence of that allows the algorithm to deduce that deep anesthesia is occurring. So that's what we call time domain assessment.
Okay. So and time, it uses an algorithm, time domain analysis. They measure burst suppression and the presence of burst suppression.
That's right.
Means that you're at some level of deep anesthesia. Good.
Correct. That's right. And so there are two algorithms that BIS uses. So you see them described as burst suppression ratio or BSR or quasi. So they're just different types of ways which the algorithm uses to detect burst suppression, and then it produces a number which then it sort of incorporates into the final BIS index, if that makes sense. All right. So what the burst suppression ratio of BSR and quasi does is that it allows burst suppression quantitation. And that's part of the time domain assessment. Now, frequency domain assessment examines the signal activity as a function of frequency. Now, what do I mean by that? So you hear this term called fast Fourier analysis or fast Fourier transformation. And you see them when we talk about things like arterial blood pressure monitoring. And the concept is that it breaks waves down into their harmonics. And by breaking the wave down into their harmonics allows you to analyze the waves more accurately. And the way that after sort of BIS does the fast Fourier transformation is that they've got two things that they look at. So one is called the beta ratio, and one is called bispectrum. Now, in the examiner's report, I think they've got the word bicoherence. So bicoherence and bispectrum are similar. So bicoherence is the squared normalized version of bispectrum. You probably don't need to know that what that means mathematically, other than to know that bicoherence is essentially the same as bispectrum. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, what do we mean by beta ratio? So beta ratio is present during light sedation and it's produced on a spectrogram. So a spectrogram is just a visual representation of the frequency band of waves. And you'll see this sometimes, if I can sort of describe it, you'll see it's like a 3D image and you see these little, and you see like a 3D waveform. So that's called a spectrogram. And what beta ratio does is it's a log ratio of the spectral power at two frequency bands. Now, what does spectral power mean? Spectral power reflects the frequency content of the signal. In other words, what it's looking for, it's looking specifically for a certain type of frequency in terms of after it does the fast Fourier analysis. And by doing that, it allows them to detect whether there's the type of anesthesia which is associated with that, and that is with light sedation. So if we think about light sedation, what are we looking at? We're looking at primarily sort of theta waves. Okay, so it's looking at the frequency content, which is associated with theta waves, which are normally sort of between sort of 4 to 8 hertz, all right? Now, what is bispectrum or bicoherence? So that's, you see that with sort of moderate sedation to light anesthesia. And the term that the BIS uses is called sync fast slow. And that's the log ratio of bispectrum at two frequency bands. Now, what does that mean? So bispectrum measures the correlation of the phase relationships with different frequencies. So remember that beta ratio is looking at the frequency content, whereas a bispectrum looks at the phase relationships. Now, what do I mean by phase? So so there's a diagram that I show to my trainees, but if I can sort of describe it to you. So you've got a couple of waves at the moment that you can sort of see on the slide. And what it shows is that when the waves are in phase, you see that the amplitude or the peaks matches one another. Okay. Whereas if they're out of phase, what you see is that the amplitude of one wave represents the positive amplitude of one wave represents the happening at the same time as the negative amplitude of another wave. So those waves are out of phase. So when you have frequencies that are in phase, the positive amplitudes match with one another. And if they're out of phase, then they don't match. And so the more it matches, the more that it's associated with moderate sedation to light anesthesia. Okay. And so that's essentially how BIS works, using that algorithm. And when we think about entropy, it uses the same idea as well, where and entropy essentially means it just measures the degree of disorder in a system. So again, it uses time domain methods, which is looking at how EEG changes over time, which is looking at the presence of burst suppression. And the second thing is that it looks at frequency domain methods, where it examines signal frequency as a function of frequency. Okay. And the only difference between entropy and BIS is that you see that entropy has two numbers. Okay. It's got state entropy and response entropy. So state entropy changes, tracks changes in the frequency between a specific band of frequency of 0 to 32 hertz. And it also has a time window of 15 to 60 seconds. And the range you'll get is 0 to 91. So it's considered a lot more stable in terms of the number. Whereas response entropy, it's got a much larger frequency range in terms of which it tracks. So it tracks a frequency range of 0 to 47 hertz. And the range of the number is anywhere sort of between 0 to 100, and the time window is 2 to 15 seconds. So what that means is that it reacts very quickly to change. In other words, if you were to use entropy and you were to give muscle relaxation, what you would see is that the response entropy number will drop first, and then after that, the state entropy will follow. Because the key thing is that when we look at EMG, EMG occurs at the higher frequency band, which state entropy doesn't measure. So response entropy, remember, measures 0 to 47 hertz, which includes EMG, whereas state entropy measures 0.8 to 32 hertz, which excludes EMG. So vice versa as well, when you're waking someone up and you reverse them and they've regained their muscle function, what you'll see is that the response entropy will rise first, and then after that, the state entropy will follow.
And so what numbers are you looking at as a sign of adequate depth of anesthesia with response entropy and state entropy?
It's the same as BIS. So
40 to 60.
Yeah, 40 to 60, exactly.
And then would you use the response entropy kind of as a warning sign?
That's right. Yeah, correct. Yeah. So the state entropy would be the one that's a lot more stable as a number, but the response entropy will give you a signal that change is happening. So that change might be an artifact. It might be the surgeon you know, close to the BIS monitor or the use of diathermy. And so what that does is that it gives you a little bit of a signal that something's happening. You look at the screen, you go, okay, no, patient is still asleep because the state entropy is still stable. What you don't want to see is response is that after you see a response entropy number go up, you don't want to see the state entropy go up as well, okay? Because that would suggest that the patient is sort of waking up.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So, and in a way, BIS, you'd probably use all of your monitoring in a way with BIS. So BIS is just one number and you're aiming roughly in a 40 to 60 yeah. for anesthesia, 60 to 80.
And so I think you should tell the audience how you measure awareness in someone who's anesthetized under your care. What are your sort of key points or key parameters that you look at?
Yeah, I think from an overall perspective, first of all, if someone's not paralyzed, there's probably little utility of using bispectral index BIS or awareness monitors because they're not paralyzed, and you will very quickly know if someone's responding. Their first response to a surgical stimulus will happen, even if they're under anesthesia and asleep. Mm. So you'll get a very quick indication as they're about to become aware through reflex muscular movements. So I think that's providing that the analgesia is not super high, you'll get a reflex response. So let's talk about just the paralyzed patient.
And that's such a good point, La, because I think you made that the patient can have a reflex movement, but they're not necessarily aware.
Yeah. So when you say, if a patient does move and your surgeon says, patient's waking up.
that's right.
That's a really inaccurate thing to say because they could have a MAC of one and the stimulus could just be very powerful. And so there's no chance this patient is awake or aware or anything.
Our surgeons love saying that. They love, my surgeon especially just loves joking around. He loves to say, Mr. So-and-so, it's okay. The anesthetic will start soon. But you and I know that our patients are asleep, and that often just represents just a reflex movement.
Yeah,
exactly. And that there's anesthesia still being delivered, but they just need to have more analgesia or more a deeper plane of anesthesia.
Yeah. And so the next thing is with the paralyzed patient, there's a couple of really big studies. And if you look at the history of the Be Aware trial and the bag recall trial, there's a few massive trials out there that tested whether BIS can prevent awareness in these high-risk populations. And to go into all of the detail, there's quite a few trials out there, and I've got to say and I think the first trial had a significant fragility index but did show that it was protective. Another trial did all patients, not just high-risk patients, and didn't show a difference. And then another big trial in high-risk patients showed that potentially there wasn't a difference in using BIS for high-risk.
And so also from my learning as well, like what is fragility index?
Fragility, I'm not the best statistics person out there, but if you took a reading, if you took a study result that showed so just to give an example, if you took a study that showed that there was a significant difference in something, the fragility would be high if all it took would be one value to change whether that something was significant or insignificant.
Yeah.
So maybe you had, maybe you had five positive cases and, 10 negative cases. And then if you changed one positive from, five to four,
yeah,
and made 11 negative cases,
you lose
significance. So these are definitely things that make statistics very interesting. And the subtlety of any trial is that maybe that was just one random error. Then would you take that trial into as absolute truth? Maybe not. You would look at the whole context of all the trials that are out there. Maybe do a meta analysis and look for something less fragile.
Yeah. So with all the results out there and knowing, the current evidence that's out there, like what's your practice with BIS? What scenarios do you use it in, or what scenarios don't you use it in?
I use BIS for a couple of reasons. Either the patient's very, very worried about awareness and they've actually mentioned it and wanted to talk more about it. First of all, they're paralyzed. Then they're either very concerned about awareness or want to talk about it. And, I'm trying to do everything possible to reassure and protect them against that. So this is one addition to it. And then the paralyzed patient who is at risk of awareness, this will be another, tool in the armamentarium to try to prevent awareness. So those cases would be those that, TEVA has always the risk of, you know, failing machinery or drip tissueing. So TEVA cases, especially the arms are tucked in, I'd be very concerned about. And then any cases where giving too much anesthetic would potentially cause cardiovascular compromise. So these cases are, imagine the sickest cardiac patients with some emergency surgery or massive blood loss cases. I'm now very worried that I can't give enough volatile propofol to keep them asleep because it'll give cardiovascular compromise. And in the most dire situations, you hope you never have to have this conversation, but you know, to tell your patient, look, we'll do everything to make sure you're asleep for this very tricky case, but often they know that they're unwell as well.
Yeah.
And you might have to have the conversation that, look, you may remember some things, but we'll keep you very well analgesed. And, you know, in that situation, you'd always give a big dose of midazolam, which is much more cardiostable, just to try and prevent awareness, even though you might be running a low MAC value.
Yeah.
So the key thing there, I think, is that, you know, I use BIS as an extra indicator of something going on and not necessarily as the fail-safe. Like, just because your BIS values are low and your patient is tachycardic, sweating, tears in their eyes, hypertensive, and you're running low BIS values and there's high stimulus in, from the surgery, I would not just take the low BIS value as a gold standard. I just look at everything. Because one of the trials which reaffirmed what we knew already was that end-tidal volatile greater than 0.7. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure this is accurate. There's been no cases of awareness when your end-tidal volatile was greater than 0.7. And obviously this is just what's reported. So maybe in certain patients who are, you know, very resistant to anesthetic for whatever reason, you wouldn't take this as a gold standard. But, you know, I make sure that I'm very confident that if my patient who's paralyzed has MAC that I'm running of one or, you know, greater than 0.7, I'm very confident that this is a reasonable situation that's not going to cause an awareness.
Yeah. And then just for the audience as well, know that the MAC on the machines that are calculated are different from the values that you might see in textbooks. Because I think the GE machines will calculate a MAC for a 40-year-old at end-tidal 2. But I think most textbooks nowadays would say that the MAC of SIVO for a 40-year-old is MAC of 1 is 1.8.
So. Yeah, and that's news to me because I've utilized that 2.1 end-tidal SIVO 1 MAC value for most of my career. And only recently I've noticed
that. I think the reason for that is that previously, many years ago, the source of truth, which is always going to be Miller's, Miller's has always said that the MAC of SIVO flowing is always 2%. But recently, in the new edition, it's come down to 1.8. And I know that when you read the product information of anesthetic of like the GE machines or Baxter, apologies. So when you read the product information for Baxter, which produces SIVO fluorine, they state that that one MAC of SIVO is 2% or 2.1%.
Yeah. And then you talk about Miller's being the gold standard, but I'm pretty sure we've got an episode where you've proven Miller's wrong. So
I think Miller's is right on this one. I think there's a lot of consistency with the number of 1.8. So so that, you know what, they do evolve and they do change over time.
So
I was going to ask you about, because one of the things that I sort of struggle with sometimes is, you know, with the elderly sick patient, and you put a BIS on them. And, you know, this is like the sick patient that comes from ICU or that you're inducing, you know, in the evenings, and their BIS after induction, you know, they sit at whatever, 30 or 40, but you're running very minimal amounts of volatiles. Like, is there a minimum amount of MAC that you would run? Because what often happens there is that you can often have them very, very low. And their BIS, if you go by the BIS, BIS number is still very low. So is there like a minimum number that you sort of go with these patients, or have to titrate it to BIS?
That's a good question. So the sickest patient, I would first of all set the age parameter so I know that, you know, 6% per decade decrement in MAC requirement. And then, you know, if I'm really struggling with hemodynamics and the, you know, sickness of this patient, I potentially would go towards MAC awake. So
almost 0.3.
Yeah, 0.3. Yeah. I think 0.3 at steady state, plus age stratified or age limited, and BIS and all the other monitors and giving midazolam. I feel like these are all, you know, just trying to get this patient through a difficult, non-ideal scenario as best as possible. And then as soon as I'm in a stable state, I might turn it up to 0.5 as well. Obviously well analgesics as well. Again, don't take this as medical advice for any specific patient. There's obviously at the very point
end. It's all patient dependent, personalized care.
And we're really titrating the most difficult situation here. So
you'll
never be doing this alone as a junior, obviously.
Yeah. It's always a balance, isn't it, between the side effects of deepening anesthesia and the risk of awareness running sort of light anesthesia at the same time. But the things that affect this are, as you said, correctly said, age, and also anything that causes sort of low cerebral metabolism. So hypovolemia, hypotension, hypoglycemia. I've got my wife going across right now. So
let her pass.
She's trying to open up a locker.
like a ninja. Didn't
like know a ninja. Yeah. I don't know whether you guys heard it or not, but hilarious. Trying to sneak in on tippy toes. Very unsuccessful though, but across the screen.
So the interesting, I just want to mention this study because I think when this study came out, it was a Cairns study, a local Australian study by Schuller, Newell, Strickland, and Barry. And I just really commend this study because not only have they done an incredible study, but also the volunteers for this study, that's some incredible courage to be part of this. Being paralyzed and still awake is incredible. And the articles, back in 2015, published in the British Journal of Anesthesia, the BJA, really high impact journal, and it's called Response of Bispectral Index to Neuromuscular Block in Awake Volunteers. And I'll put the link for that. And this was really interesting because I think it gave evidence for what a lot of us realize, that every time we give paralysis to patients, which is not a hypnotic, it doesn't have any amnestic potential, we give paralysis and the biz drops. And in this study, it was remarkable because they show that giving paralysis to awake patients, given no hypnotic at all, the biz would drop often for minutes below 60. So if you were literally just looking at this number, it would tell you that your patients were unaware when they clearly were aware.
Yes.
So I think that was the conclusion, the conclusion really is that, these results suggest that the biz monitor requires muscle activity in addition to an awake EEG in order to generate values indicating that the subject is awake.
Yes.
Consequently, biz may be an unreliable indicator of awareness in patients who have received neuromuscular blocking drugs. And that's a pretty fair statement from the results that they've got.
Which is, and we use this in patients who are paralyzed. I mean, isn't it?
Yeah, that is my, one of the criteria for using biz. And now in this study, they've said, potentially this is not that useful. And, I'm not sure what to tell people. I will use biz because it's another tool in the armamentarium, but am I thinking it's the fail-safe? Am I thinking it's everything? Absolutely not.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And I think they had a tourniquet on the arm, didn't they, to actually prevent muscle relaxation so that they could actually still be able to sort of communicate with the with the researchers.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing, right? So this was an old technique. The isolated forearm technique is inflating a cuff above arterial pressure before giving the muscle relaxant. So no, drug is going through into the forearm. So this forearm still has all the neural connectivity and is able to move through muscle function. So so they would ask.
And these patients were intubated. Is that right?
I didn't see whether they intubated, but they were definitely bag masked during this. I don't know whether they're intubated. I'll through that. But so what's interesting, they, just to check awareness and recall, they would give some things that the patients had to memorize. It also asked them to do some mathematical sums, which were done, I think with 96% accuracy. And the recall was very good. So they were definitely aware. That was proof of awareness. And they also had that fail safe that if there's any distress, there's a predetermined indicator from the hand signal. And so they'd be given a rescue dose of propofol just to make sure that they're unaware.
Interesting. Yeah, I agree. And the things that I've sort of noticed with some of my experiences with anesthesia and muscle relaxation is that when there's inadequate muscle relaxation, often the first sign that you'll see is actually the heart rate going up. I don't know whether you've noticed that at all, but As in, one of the things that I often look at is that, if you have a NMT monitor, mm-hmm. and you know it may not be working for whatever reason, mm-hmm. and then during a case where you provide paralysis, you see the heart rate just shoot up, mm-hmm. and you go, oh, what's happening? And then after that, the next thing you see is that the patient is fighting the ventilator.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of dawns on you that, yes, that the muscle relaxation has worn off. And you're still providing, you know, a Mac of one. And that may be inadequate to prevent the patient making spontaneous efforts to breathe. Mm. But it's quite interesting to see the correlation between the use of muscle relaxation and BIS.
Anyway, I'll put the link to that study. Have a read, because I'm impressed that this study came out of Australia, because I can't imagine how hard that was to get through ethics. Depending on your ethics department, it's been very difficult, I've heard.
Tell you what, it's a good study.
Brave volunteers. I'd love to actually, you know, I might even just, I'd love to have a chat with the authors just to...
I'd rather have a chat to the volunteers. Wouldn't that be amazing to be paralyzed? Imagine to be paralyzed.
Yeah.
Not being able to move. Have someone else breathe for you.
Here's the call out. If the volunteers of that study would love to be on this podcast, or even the authors, we'd love to have you talking about BIS, talking about how you came up with the study and your experience of it. I think that would be a really interesting podcast.
That would be a very interesting podcast. Maybe one for a different podcast, hey?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Anesthesia tea break.
Well, we've already had enough coffee, right? Next thing, we'll have anesthesia fine dining. for the highbrow anesthetist.
I don't think we'll get many viewerships there.
Anyway.
Good stuff.
Is that pretty much the summary?
And then look, the last thing that that we need to sort of think about when we use BIS is all those things which you talked about, as well as any other possible things which may cause artifacts to this. So some types of anesthetic agents are known to cause disturbances, and those can include sort of ketamine, mm-hmm. Etomidate, which can all increase BIS numbers. Nitrous oxide is quite interesting. So it's a little bit controversial. Mm-hmm. And the best description that I found is that so it does change your EEG waves. It does increase the amplitude of high frequency EEG waves and decreases the amplitude of low frequency EEG wave. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the BIS number itself, it doesn't change that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you get some normal EEG states like dementia, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and mm-hmm. anything that we sort of mentioned before in terms of interference sort of near the EEG waves, so pacemakers, any sort of surgical devices around the EEG waves. And that's probably it. And that would be how I would go about answering that question on EEGs and BIS.
Nice. And just to summarize then, the factors that influence it in terms of an artifact type situation, so EMG artifact, medical devices, causes of low cerebral metabolism, whatever that might be, hyperglycemia, cardiac arrest, et cetera, abnormal EEG states, dementia, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and then all the anesthetic agents that you just mentioned. So that's a really good framework, I think, for thinking about all the ways that this is going to be affecting your reading. Excellent. Good, good.
Good stuff.
Excellent. Thanks very much, everyone, for listening and watching. And thanks, Dan, for such a comprehensive review of BIS, because I think, like most of us, we look at the number and we're happy with it. And I hope this was a nice little deep dive into the details of BIS, especially for this exam. So thanks very much for listening and watching. Please support us on Patreon. The link will be below, and see you next time. Thanks.